Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Whiskey Congress is back in session. We're actually joined. I'm talking to Steve via Zoom, and we've got a guest. Steve, would you like to introduce our guest?
Sure. We've got, we call him Market Ben. He's our money guy. We talked to Market with him. He's been on the show multiple times before. You know, it's been crazy since the last time we talked to you, Ben. First of all, how you doing, man? How you hanging in there?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, guys. I always enjoy joining you guys and talking shop. I'm good, disease-free, able to avoid this virus up until now. So hopefully that continues, but hanging in there, excited to close the year.
Good deal. So, you know, last time we talked to you was, you know, right before the election. And there was, you know, a lot of talk around the water cooler, that related to the markets. A lot of people saying, man, you know, a lot of people just guessing and speculating that if Biden won, then, you know, you could see, a market crash, big market sell-off, things like that. That's not what you were saying at all. In fact, you were saying that, basically a Biden victory had already been priced in. And we should expect to see the market respond, maybe in different sectors, but one way or another, the market's going to keep moving in a positive direction. And that's what we saw. So, you know, you want to talk a little bit about what we actually saw and kind of how it rolled?
Yeah. I mean, first, what I would say is for your listeners and viewers to go back and listen to our conversation the week prior to the election. That thesis did play out, in fact. And if you'll recall in our conversation here live, but, you know, if for listeners that go back and listen, we talked about some of the baskets of stocks that a lot of analysts had kind of put together. I know Goldman had a basket, a Biden basket, and a Trump basket. And those were loudly signaling that the market had anticipated a Biden victory and was anticipating it in a way that translated to elevated prices and risk assets. So, you know, it was basically just following what the market was telling us. So what we've seen since then, obviously, is a few things. Number one, we've seen continued very accommodative monetary policy. There was just the FOMC meeting last week where Powell has just continued to reiterate, lower for longer federal funds rate, which is obviously great for risk assets. I think the key right now is the stimulus package that has been continually delayed. That's our biggest risk factor right now. Generally, when you get to this part of the year, the proximity to a calendar turn, there's either a snowball of tax loss selling that drags everything down, or you see something like what we're seeing right now, which is essentially a melt up. Sometimes people call it a Santa rally. People call it all kinds of different things, but seasonally, and I think you follow my LinkedIn, Steve, you've seen me post quite a bit about this end of year and first quarter melt up, which is kind of what we've seen. And it's, those are the factors that have largely played into it. So I'd say that's, those are the key elements that we've seen drive these prices higher.
Well, and do you want to talk about, we talked about a little bit on our last show or maybe the show before about Trump's press conference, when the Dow hit 30,000, not necessarily about his weird sort of press conference, but just kind of the significance of that number and why it was so significant that Trump thought it was important to have a 30-second press conference to acknowledge it.
Sure. Well, the short answer is there's absolutely zero significance to it. It's just another number. For Trump, he's measured his success by the stock market, which is completely detached from reality, not the market, although you could make that argument. I'll listen to that argument. But his view of his success as an executive has been tied to the stock market. So really, it was just a nice round number. Maybe the same reason people think Bitcoin is huge when it got to 20,000, we regained 20,000. So really an arbitrary number, but clearly he wanted to celebrate that number, because in his view, and counterintuitively, this happened after the election. So it's kind of, I had a good chuckle because I was sitting there watching, scratching my head, wondering if he realized, you know, the market's gone higher because you didn't win. apparently that was completely lost on him.
What did he call it? He called it like a sacred number or something like that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. He said a sacred number. Stable genius with the best words.
And he's a very religious guy because he has the army escort him to a church to hold up a Bible. So
that's right. Yeah.
While pepper spraying people along the route. Yep. So we did see we have seen some sell off since then.
Yeah.
I look at, you know, various things, on the economic calendar. Obviously you look at everything on the economic calendar, and I can only process so much, but, you know, there's a term that I've become familiar with probably over the last like 18 months, dealing with quad, which, you know, typically you see a big sell-off and a lot of market volatility. You want to talk to us a little bit about that, what it is, kind of, you know, when we see it and why, and then what, like, does it, you know, for you, does it matter, and how do you kind of prepare for it, if at all?
Sure. it's a great question. It's a little bit of a wonky question, right? So I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on it, but essentially what a quad witching is, it happens on a quarterly basis, and it's basically the expiration of both options and futures in individual stocks. So in equities, it's also the expiration of options and futures in the index funds, the major index funds. So that's why it's quad. There's four of them. Now that rotates. It's not always a quad witching. Sometimes there's triple witching. It just depends on the way that the market calendar shakes out. And essentially what that means is a lot of hedged positions are coming to expiration. And so a lot of rebalancing takes place. So if you've got a hedged position that you need to either cover or, just cut out, there's going to be a lot of stock that transacts during that period. And we saw that this past Friday, as you mentioned, which was just yesterday. The market, for the most part, depending on what your book looked like, if you were more tech heavy, more NASDAQ heavy, the market was pretty weak throughout the day. And then that last 20 minutes was just staggering with the rip higher. So yeah, it's crazy the way that works. But so a lot of that was rebalancing. And you also had another variable that's really important to note, which is Tesla's inclusion into the S&P. So Tesla, there was about, based on official indexes, funds that track the index officially, there was about $80 billion worth of Tesla stock that had to be purchased to include it into the, you know, the S&P indexes. In addition to that, there was, you know, the unofficial indexes that was probably somewhere between 40 and all the way up to 80 billion as well. So you probably saw anywhere from like 120 to $160 billion of Tesla stock trade in that one trading session. A lot of it concentrated either in the first 30 minutes or really in like the last 20 or 15 minutes.
I'm not a Tesla fanboy. It's just crazy how this stock has skyrocketed. It's a little too pricey for my blood. Oddly enough, I have made some money off some Tesla options over the last couple months, just because, I mean, why not? And I'm seeing, like, you know, in dark pools where, I mean, the, you know, a lot of strikes at like 700, which seems just astronomical to me, but I mean, it's at 660 now. So, I mean, I don't know what's going to stop it from getting there. I think that any person with a, you know, with a discerning eye is going to look at that stock and say, at some point the bubble is going to burst. Right. But I guess the question is when, right?
Yeah. Boy, if I knew the answer to that question, I'm not trying to be on Zoom with you guys right now. I might be somewhere in the Bahamas.
It's Zoom. You could still do it from the Bahamas.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
It'd be more fun for you. You could laugh at us as palm trees sway behind you.
I've done it to Jim in Mexico.
He did. He did it shirtless.
Yeah, I'll get one of those virtual backgrounds too. It'll look great. No, look, it's a great question. And with regard to Tesla, you know, I'm right there with you, Steve. I mean, it's obviously been a, you know, an unbelievable outperformer. Again, inclusion in the S&P has definitely helped ramp that up. The other catalyst was when they did the split, the stock split, which generally shouldn't matter much. But again, you have a lot of new retail investors that have entered the space. And you brought up an interesting point when you mentioned options. And I think we touched on this in one of our last conversations, but it's worth revisiting. You know, when you have retail investors coming in buying naked call options, meaning they don't own the underlying asset, the dealer that's selling those options has to hedge their position. They can write naked calls too. I mean, if you've got level 5 options clearance, you can write naked calls, but generally you have to hedge that, and you hedge it by owning the underlying asset itself. So all of this influx of call buying against Tesla has required the dealers to actually purchase stock, and that's a bit of a buyer as well. So that's another factor. The other factor is secular with regard to EV. I know you and I have talked about this offline with regard to EV. You've seen it in other names like Fisker and NIO, et cetera. So that's a thematic trade that I think, you know, probably has some legs thematically. You know, when you take single stock risk in that type of space, you can run into some trouble. But, you know, that's kind of my feeling on Tesla, is that it's, you know, it is getting pretty rich. I've read analyst notes on the street that put it at $700 a share. I think it could easily get there, frankly. It's hard to know right now what would kind of bring it back down to earth outside of the rest of the market selling off. If the rest of the market sells off, and I would expect sometime in Q1, we'll see a 10 to 15% correction. Tesla is going to be a source of funds for a lot of investors. Source of funds meaning they're going to sell it and book those profits. So
grab the cash.
If Tesla comes down, it'll come down pretty hard.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, I mean, we'll definitely keep an eye out on that. So, and if any of our listeners, if you have a position with Tesla, then just, you know, pay attention. Although, you know, I don't know if we have any huge big time investors, you know, that have major positions with it, but I mean, it's worth noting. So, you know, with that, you know, talking to tech stocks, let's, you know, make a little bit of a transition talking about the future. Biden did win the election. You know, Trump is making his push to say that he won.
I'm willing to say that. There's some people on Capitol Hill that are still unwilling to do that. So, yes.
Yeah, I mean, which is terrifying, but okay. So, you know, Biden is starting to make appointments to his new administration. You know, everybody's got their, you know, everybody in the talking head space has their opinions. But he did appoint Janet Yellen to the Fed chair position, which is currently held by Jerry Powell, old Uncle Jerry. So what do you think about that? Because, you know, Yellen's been in this position before. So what do you think about her making a comeback, and, you know, where do we go?
Well, actually, she hasn't. She's the very first female.
That's right. I'm sorry.
Yeah. She was a Fed chair, so she had Jerry's job. And as a market, you know, net bull, I'm a net bull. I don't call myself exclusively a bull because I do have to hedge. So sometimes when the market rolls over, it benefits me based on positioning. But I'll just say that I think she's very, you know, very conducive to the market moving in a positive higher direction. She's very much dovish. And in fact, her comments, even leading up to her appointment, were such that she was aggressively suggesting further fiscal action, independent of the monetary thing. I mean, what Powell and the Fed and the FOMC have done is unprecedented and was incredibly effective, but they can only go so far. As you guys know, Congress holds the purse strings. So we've gotten to the point, and you can listen to it in all of his comments in each of these FOMC meetings. He continues to drive home the point. We need fiscal stimulus. We can't do much more on the monetary side. And in fact, one of the reasons why Yellen, I think, is a more attractive option versus Mnuchin, who, by the way, I will say Mnuchin's done a good job. And in fact, he's one of the few people that I would say has been reasonable through these negotiations as it relates to next iteration of stimulus, excuse me. But now on his way out, he's looking to limit the Fed lending facilities. I'm sure you've read this or heard this over the last several days and weeks. They want to actually take those dollars that Treasury pledged to the Fed and take them back, and in fact, close out the facilities, which would kind of hamstring the Biden administration moving in. Now, of course, they can make changes themselves. And of course, the Fed is supposed to be 100% apolitical, which I think they've done a good job of being. But overall, you know, Yellen is very bullish for markets. In fact, the market reacted in a positive way when her appointment was leaked out. Of course, she still has to be confirmed through Congress, but I would expect that happens without, you know, much resistance.
And so with that, you know, what's your, I mean, obviously we're waiting on stimulus. Like that's probably the biggest driver right now, that when that happens, and depending on how robust it is, we'll definitely probably likely see a positive kind of reaction in the market. But just kind of, what do you see with this Biden administration? Like, what do you see the markets looking like going forward?
Well, first thing I'll say is that I think that the stimulus package is priced in now. So if somehow there's a hiccup or it comes in under that $900 billion range, roughly what that is, market would probably react in an ornery way. You know, we might see some chop. So that's the first thing is, you know, the expectation of stimulus is there. We could see a 2 or 3 day pop if, you know, when in fact this does. Apparently, you know, McConnell yesterday had essentially gotten approved another 48 hour extension to fund the government. As you guys know, there was going to be a government shutdown last night. We averted that. Now it's Sunday midnight deadline. So the expectation is we'll have legislation on the floor ready for vote early next week. So my expectation is that will go down and that'll happen and materialize. Of course, there's some last minute wrangling on some of the details, but let's put that aside for a moment. The next piece is the January 5th runoffs in Georgia. And the reason that's important is because obviously it's going to define who's controlling the Senate. And if in fact, which it sounds like, and I'm not, I try to be, I'm not a great political analyst, but if the Democrats happen to sweep those two seats, which sounds that is more improbable than the alternative, that could be problematic because you'll see the potential for meaningful tax changes, you know, have a higher probability of getting passed through Congress at that point. Now, I've also heard people on the left say, hey, look, we recognize that the economy is still wounded. We still have a long way to go before we can get aggressive about, you know, changing our tax policy and putting more pressure on businesses. So I think there's still, you know, some sensitivity to where we are as an economy, but the next catalyst will definitely be that January 5th runoff. And my hope as a market net bull is to see divided government. So one or zero of those seats going to the Republican candidates would be great. Now, of course, we could also have a side conversation about Perdue and Loeffler and their stock trading, particularly Perdue. Talk about 2,600 trades, I think they said, in like a matter of 2 or 3 years. I mean, I don't even come close to trading that much.
Right,
he must not be a very good trader if he's trading that much.
That's crazy.
People out there don't have to transact that much.
2,600 in a year.
Right. I mean, that's absurd.
In 2 years, like 2 or 3 years.
Okay. Well, still absurd, but.
You're still talking about a ridiculous number. I mean, that's 1,300 trades a year, which is.
That's like 20 a day. I mean, it's insane.
Right. It's just crazy. Like, what are you doing? Like, I mean, it's just like you've got ADD just hitting buttons, you know?
I think the real issue there, though, is a lot of these companies, the specific names he was trading were names that he had oversight over with regard to his committee membership.
I mean, and Loeffler did the same thing. It's just like she did it, you know, a few times with some really big names that, she, you know, again, committee, you know, she comes out of a committee meeting and it's like, hey, we need to sell XYZ. And it's just like, that is the fucking definition of all the rules. right? Like you just broke all of them.
Ken's husband runs NYSE, so.
Right. I mean, it's just.
Insider trading is one thing when you're actually the influencer of the policy and then trading on it. That's.
Yeah, you know, I'm surprised, you know, Martha Stewart hasn't had something to say about this. She went to prison for insider trading.
Dude, Martha's living a good life with Snoop right now. She don't give a fuck.
Yeah. Well, her activity was much less egregious than these two, but.
Martha already got her proverbial dick ripped off. I think she's good with all this.
Yeah, but to wrap it up, just to wrap up the question that you had asked, I do anticipate that markets will, you know, continue to grind a little bit higher. The other piece to keep in mind here again, and it's kind of contingent on that January 5th runoff, the Biden administration has signaled pretty loudly that a new iteration of stimulus will come even after that. So the real key here is, and by the way, there's a little tidbit that's important to note that was discussed on Friday yesterday after the markets closed, which is that banks can now buy back stock. They can now re-engage with dividend yield. That's going to be helpful too, to help boost some of these more beaten down sectors, the financials in particular. So one of the other themes that you hear a lot from analysts is this rotation trade, rotation from growth into value. So you're talking about, you know, the energy sectors, the travel and leisure sectors, all these sectors that have just gotten obliterated via COVID. Those stand to do very well if there's further stimulus and more aggressive and generous stimulus that can just help prevent some of those credit events and defaults. We've talked about this specifically in previous conversations that we've had. It's important to remember, whether you're a deficit hawk or not, on the other side of COVID, once this vaccine is fully distributed and this is a thing, you know, in effect of the past, we're going to have to rebuild this economy and all of the attrition that you allow to happen in the interim. This is now becoming permanent attrition. A lot of these businesses are never coming back. You've only weakened your foundation upon which you're going to build the economy on the other side of COVID. So it's, to me, and I'm a conservative, you know, I'm a fiscal conservative as well, frankly. I'd prefer to see more aggressive stimulus just to help these businesses survive to get to the other side. Because, these are, when you think about SMEs, you know, we talk about it all the time. And when I say SMEs, I'm talking about small to medium enterprises. You know, these guys employ over 50% of the U.S. population. So as you allow that attrition in that space, it really handicaps the recovery on the other side. So I think that's just something to really important to note, because when I'm listening to these Republicans right now, as they debate the current stimulus, I mean, they're just living in an alternate reality. It's really frustrating. And it's unfortunately, I think it's damaging to the conservative ideology, as was Trump.
So Ben, as much more of a layman than you and Steve, when it comes to the markets, I always think that instability in the government is the worst thing for the market from a government perspective. Right now, we've got an outgoing president who's not saying he's definitely going to leave when he's supposed to be out. We've got Congress playing who knows what games under the table, but above table, jerking around a stimulus package in a country that's really, really hurting. And yet the market seems to be doing well.
Yes.
So what do you attribute that to?
100% the Fed. 100% the Fed. When the Fed acted so quickly, back in March, and basically did some unprecedented things. When the Fed started buying corporate debt, and I'm not talking about just investment grade debt, they were buying high yield debt, which is risky stuff, you know? Then they got to buying ETFs. I mean, the Fed has basically proven they're the lender of last resort. They're going to close any wide spreads, you know, if the market gets locked up and spreads get too wide. The Fed has signaled that they have not only the appetite, but the wherewithal to accomplish keeping the markets functioning properly. So I think that's largely why investors have so much confidence. But also to your point, Jim, the market stopped responding to Trump in late summer, early fall. Nobody cares anymore. This is an outgoing president. The market had already kind of anticipated a Biden win. Back then, when you guys remember, Steve, you brought it up off the top of the show. We were talking about that back in in August. So the market doesn't care about Trump anymore. He's, you know, is he now, could he do some crazy stuff? And I'm sure he will. Sure he could, but it's not going to impact the financial markets. It could impact us from a social standpoint, but I don't anticipate any issues there.
Yeah, I'm anticipating there may be some moves from Trump that feel like he's going scorched earth, like I'm going to burn the White House down before I leave it. But I don't think he would do anything deliberately to hurt the market, because like you said, that's his bragging point the whole time.
Yeah, that's been his measure of success since he got into markets. And I'll make another comment, Steve, based on a question that you asked a little bit ago when you talked about your listeners, and there's not a lot of, maybe, you know, either they're very new to the markets or just kind of getting their feet wet. I think one thing that that you can take away from all of the conversations in aggregate that we've had, and I always encourage people just to get in the game. There's no reason at this point to not be invested in some kind of risk asset, because you're not going to get paid on interest anymore in this environment. And the Fed has signaled that they aren't even interested in discussing interest rate increases until at least 2023. So if you're sitting in a savings account and getting paid, like, you know, 10 bips, I mean, you're getting outpaced by inflation. You're actually losing money by your money just sitting there, because, you know, if you rate inflation and let's just say it's 2%, that's the general measure.
Inflation is 2%, but I mean, a savings account, if you're getting 1%, then that may be considered good these days. It's crazy.
If you're getting 1%, that's, I mean, give me the name of your bank. That's wild.
Citibank.
As you're getting paid at the point. Yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, and it's a good conduit through which people can maybe get used to trading and get more comfortable with it and learn the vernacular and learn the dynamics. And you don't have to get too far in the weeds on some of the stuff that I talk about, or even play with options and things like that. Really, in fact, I have a colleague of mine. We've got some time set aside tomorrow just to talk. And, you know, she's trying to just get her feet wet. And we're going to be talking about thematic trades, you know, ETF trades. And it's interesting because when she first shared her portfolio with me, I kind of had a little bit of a chuckle. I mean, it's not funny, but you know, we've said it before, when you treat the market like a casino or you treat it like a lottery, you're going to get casino and lottery results. And so that's why when I see people and they show me their portfolio and it's a bunch of these penny stocks, it's like, you know, there's two things that depend that are going to, you know, essentially determine your success or failure in the market. One of them is your quality of decision-making. The other is luck. Now, and it's really just that. It's really those two things. I mean, you could argue also size and stuff, sizing trades, that has a huge impact, but you can control the quality of your decision-making. You can't really control luck. And over the course of time, you know, if you're controlling and you're really focused on improving your quality of decision making, you're going to overtake that luck element tenfold. Luck won't matter to you anymore. Are you going to have bad trades? We all have bad trades, but you're going to consistently make better and better trades. It's kind of like the guy that's batting, you know, 350 in the major leagues for his entire career. That guy's going to the Hall of Fame, you know, and he failed 65% of the time, you know. So, and in fact, there's a great book that I would like to recommend to your listeners and viewers, that isn't necessarily an investing book, but it's really a book that's applicable to just your everyday life, because it's about making quality decisions and how to discern, you know, the facts that are available to you and the facts that you don't have available to you. It's actually a book called Thinking in Bets, BETS, Thinking in Bets. It's by, in fact, some of you guys may know her name, Annie Duke. She was a poker player. Yeah. And so, in fact, she actually has a master's degree in cognitive psychology. So she's got a really, really interesting background. But she talks about in her book, and I just was reading it this week. In fact, I'm pissed at myself I didn't read it before. But it's just such a great book, because it gets you away from looking at results, you know, the results of your decision. Because sometimes you're going to get a bad result, but you did all the right due diligence and made a good decision, but you got a bad result. That shouldn't deter you from using that same methodology to make a quality decision in the future. They call it resulting in the book. In fact, one of the great examples she uses with Pete Carroll in the 2015 Super Bowl. you guys will remember, they had the ball, they were down four, had the ball on the 1 yard line of Seattle with 20 some seconds to go. And he decided to run a pass play, which of course was intercepted and they lost the Super Bowl. But if you go back and really, and he, of course he got piled on, right? This was the dumbest coach ever. Let's fire this guy. What a dunce. But when you go back and think about that decision that he made in that context with regard to the number of timeouts and the clock management aspect, but also the percentages on that getting intercepted was like less than 2%. I read the statistic that it had never been, it had never happened all season long when they've been in that scenario where a pass had been intercepted in that context. And so you had to go back and really think about that. And yeah, was the result, you know, suboptimal, to put it lightly? Yeah, of course it was. But it was the right decision, because if you're making decisions based on probable outcomes, I mean, we don't have all the facts. We have to make decisions on probable outcomes. And that's what investing is all about. Certainly that's how playing the market is from a, you know, if you're leveraging trades and things like that. So you have to operate with the mindset of probable outcomes and not, you know, what the results ultimately are, because we're all going to make bad decisions.
That was a great illustration, but I'm not going to agree with you from a football perspective.
Well, that's why you're not an investor, Jim.
Fair enough. I was going to say, the book was by Annie Duke. It's the equivalent of going all in with a pair of aces pre-flop. Those aces get cracked sometimes. It happened to me in a tournament once. I'm like, I did what I had to do. I mean, I had two aces and two people went all in front of me. I was definitely going to win that hand, or was definitely favored to win that hand. But one guy had pocket tens and a 10 came on the flop and I packed my bags.
And, you know, and Jim, you'll love the book, because she uses so many examples of her poker career where, you know, things like those outcomes, they just happen. I mean, that's, you know, that's why when somebody says, you know, oh, it's 100-1, you know, that would happen. Well, there's always that one time in 100 that it does happen. So that's the reason, but it still shouldn't change. It still doesn't change your decision making, right? It's in hindsight. You say, oh man, I shouldn't have done that. But in fact, no, you should have done that. You did the right thing, because decisions become habitual. And if you consistently make quality decisions on aggregate over a long enough time horizon, you're going to do very, very well.
As I was walking out of the casino, that's exactly what I was telling myself. Like, if you're not going to play that hand that way, then don't enter the tournament in the first place, because you can't fold everything.
And you probably wouldn't have even gotten in the front door of that tournament if that was the way you made decisions going into it. So, you know, so it's just a fun little anecdote, but a great book for investors and just people interested in you know, trying to make better decisions in life. It's a great book for everybody.
Thank you for the recommendation. I'll definitely be checking that out, because I do like Annie Duke a lot and I like poker and I'd like to learn more about the markets.
Yeah. Awesome.
So I
definitely like to read. So I'll definitely check that out as well, with my weird little chime in there. So, you know, Ben, again, as always, we always appreciate the time and the information you bring to us. I guess, you know, we'll do what we normally do. You know, you want to plug if you want to plug Steelyard and your social media. I know you hate social media, but maybe plug it anyway so people can check your shit out.
I've kind of bifurcated my social media a little bit. I still tweet a little bit about the markets, and I always will, obviously, because it's always top of mind. But my Twitter handle is EXIS10TIAL, existential. In fact, I think many years ago when we first talked, I gave the background as to why my handle is that. One of these days, we'll get back to that. But my hedge fund is called Steelyard Capital. You can find me on LinkedIn, Steelyard Capital. You can find our website, whatever. But if you're interested in market analysis and just some interesting charts and some of the things that Steve and I were talking off the top, you know, go ahead and follow Steelyard Capital on LinkedIn, which is kind of where I've consolidated all my kind of more esoteric, in the weeds, kind of wonked out market analysis. So you can check me out there too. And yeah, let's, you know, we should probably reconnect sometime in the first quarter and, you know, see how some of this stuff plays out. Again, I think that January 5th date should be circled on any investor's calendar as to, you know, what that'll mean for the balance of power in Congress. And, you know, and again, hopefully we can get better and better news on this vaccination distribution. It sounds like there's gonna be more iterations. The Moderna vaccine was approved over this weekend, and it sounds like there's a couple more iterations on the way from Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca. So the faster that happens, the more we can get back to normalcy, the quicker, the more you'll see markets, embrace that and, see some, thematic trades move higher.
Yeah, and I think what we'll do is we'll definitely get together again, probably early February. Let's get the inauguration through, and let's get, Trump out of the White House and Biden comfortably in. Who knows? Maybe Trump has a last-ditch effort where the roof is blown off and he's able to prove that the Russians did everything and they wanted Biden to win. Who knows? I don't know. Yeah. Thanks again, as usual. We're going to take a quick break and then get back into the other news of the day.
Yeah, I appreciate it, guys. Thanks so much.
Yep. Thanks, Ben.
All right, take care, guys.
Take care.
Yep.
So we're back. Thanks again to Ben for coming on. Now we get to do what we do. And I kind of wish I'd stuck with him for a little bit longer, because I wonder what he would have said about the Russian cyber attack. Now, I don't think it's officially known it's by Russia, but apparently we have been our government computer systems have been hacked by a foreign entity, and they really don't seem to know what information they got. And that's terrifying to me.
Yeah. And so I heard something really interesting about this. I was listening to, the POTUS panel, and there was an intelligence expert on, and he said what they're trying to figure out is if this was an attack or if this was about information. And he said there's a difference between the two, because on the one hand, did they plant something, leave something virus related that could hurt our government cyber infrastructure, or was it about stealing information? And what type of information was it digging for dirt, or was it, looking for codes to missiles or whatever? And we don't know, we're in the dark. It's scary, but this is the second major attack in 2 to 3 months that we've had here in the US. There was a really bad one that happened with our healthcare system, actually like right before I went into the hospital. For the issues I was having, there was a really bad healthcare attack, cyber healthcare attack, where they got in and they basically wiped out multiple systems to multiple hospitals, where, nurses, doctors didn't have access to patient data and they had to do everything by hand. And then anything that they did by hand, they had to go back and re-enter into the system once they regained access to the system days later. So if you imagine that multiplying out how many patients they see per day, per hour, just how much of an issue that caused. So I think there's definitely an issue.
Yeah. Right? And what you just described is just malignant. It's just someone wants to do damaging things because you like to do the Joker. Some people want to just see the world burn. That's what motivates that. But if... and maybe there's some financial gain to blowing up people's information systems, although I don't know what that would be. But if they're getting inside and getting at stuff that we obviously felt the need to keep secret, the Republicans lost their shit over Hillary's emails being on a server that they felt wasn't secure. This is a whole lot more dangerous than that. So
yeah.
Anyway, I don't know exactly what this is. I'm certainly not a cybersecurity expert, although... it is not lost on me that Trump fired his head of cybersecurity shortly after the election because he called it the most secure election ever. And then next thing you know, you're fired. And that's where stability in government is a good thing, is when you don't have shit like that happening.
Right. And we talked, this is one of the things we talked about, right? Trump had fired the head of cybersecurity. He fired the... he had fired other people in the defense secretary the secretary of defense. And so the question was, man, does this create a vacuum where we end up getting attacked because, there's a level of instability in our defenses? And I think people were thinking of a physical attack, right? Where they were thinking of something popping off in the Middle East. They were thinking Russia trying to make a move on somebody in Europe. something happening in Africa, or, you know, someone trying to do, I think, outside chance, someone trying to pull something off here in the States, a bombing attack of some sort. But I don't think any of us were really thinking about a cyber attack. And we should have lumped that in, especially with the head of cybersecurity being, you know, punted over nonsense. And here we are. So we don't know what this means. We don't want to, the government doesn't know the total effect. So I think it's kind of crazy for you and I to kind of speculate on how bad it is, because the reality is we'll probably never really know until somebody writes a book in a couple years,
right,
to tell us how bad it was. And by then we'll forget about it and be like, oh yeah, that was totally a thing. But it's worth noting, and it is scary. And I think that there have been people clamoring for, you know, an infrastructure upgrade, you know, which included everything from our streets and bridges to our, you know, our networks, our cybersecurity, our networks in government and across the board with our electrical grids and power and nuclear stuff. And I think this is why.
Right. Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism czar during 9/11, after that mess got, cleaned up from a governmental standpoint, that's what he went into, was cybersecurity, because he said he thought that was the biggest risk going forward, because so much of our data and our lives, I mean, revolve around electronic transfer of funds and other things that are not physical entities. And this is something that I really hope Biden has a plan for, because he's probably going to inherit a mess. And
we already know off the rip. I mean, Biden's definitely inheriting a mess, and part of it, like, I mean, obviously from a cybersecurity standpoint, but on a broader scale, we know that Trump didn't. There were a lot of positions that Trump never filled in his 4 years. He never made appointments. He never, people were never hired, and a lot of it was their attempt of draining the swamp, right? Like, so we're going to cut down on government administrative services by just not filling these particular positions. And while he thinks that it helps cut government payroll, by not doing it strategically and just cutting off heads and of entire departments, and, you know, because there were still people working in these certain positions, right? But there was no one over them, which is just, right, you know, kind of bizarre. And you had people fighting for power. You had situations where people just, like, you know, just entire, sections or agencies where there was no direction, right? People just showed up for work and kind of did what they had been working on with the Obama administration, with no direction from the Trump administration on what to do, and people just keeping their heads down because they didn't want to get fired. And it just, the morale is bad. And, you know, there's a lot of weaknesses there. Obviously from the cyber entity, but just in terms of overall strength of government. And if you want to cut back on the government overhead, which I totally get, that's fine. It is bloated, but you have to do it strategically. You can't just say, all right, well, we're just going to not hire this guy, and we're not going to hire that guy, we're not going to fill these positions, but we're going to leave the rest of an agency to do whatever, right? Like, that probably ends up costing you more money in the long run.
To bring it up again, but that's why I was so furious with the results of the pandemic, when there was a team in place that was supposed to be able to respond quickly if this shit happened, and they saved that money from the government. Great, guys. How'd that work out for you?
Well, that wasn't about saving money. That was John Bolton consolidating power. And then John Bolton, you know, really not knowing what the hell he was doing. And then ultimately being out of there, and then them just, you know, not thinking it was important because it didn't make money for them, which is just really, really frustrating, because you can't say that a pandemic team makes this 100 times better, but, you know, with the right people in place, who knows, maybe it could have helped save some lives and sped up some of these processes. But,
it wouldn't have hurt. We know that.
No, it definitely wouldn't have hurt. So, jumping to the next topic, we're going to get out of that. Trump is Trump, and Team MAGA and all the different things that they're doing to try to keep Trump in power. I don't really want to talk about it. I know it's a hot topic, but I think the more you talk about some of the things they're doing, it lends more power to it. It gives it more credence. And I don't want to give Trump and his following any more momentum. You know, I think bringing some of the stuff up that they're trying to pull off, it's just so sloppily done. It's done with the full intent. They know that they're breaking rules of civil procedure in court, and they know that they're doing it intentionally to create so much chaos and confuse people, you know, who aren't in the know, and to generate so much fervor in the public that they end up staying in power just because people are paralyzed by having to try to analyze all the different bullshit that they're doing. And I think that if you just say, fuck you, go off into your little corners, whether it's Parler or your little rallies where there's 20 of you in West Park or whatever, and you literally just ignore them, you know, we can get through to the inauguration on January 21st and move on. You know, we got to keep an eye on them because they're talking some dangerous stuff. Mike Flynn was talking about using the military and martial law in certain places. So we got to keep an eye on them. And if they do something, then we have to react. But for right now, I think the move is to move on to other topics.
Sounds good. Real quick though, when the Mike Flynn thing happened, you texted me, he's earning his pardon, and boy, is he ever.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Mike Flynn got on Newsmax and, you know, made some pretty wild statements about using martial law to, you know, lock down states so that they can have these forced recounts of votes and analyze the machines and you know, pull in independent electors and new votes. And guys, none of this stuff is constitutional, right? When you put it all together, none of it equates to Trump being, you know, named president and victor. Like, no one's going to do that. Like, Trump is not going to remain president. If you feel cheated at this point, like, I'm not going to argue with you about why you weren't cheated. I'm just going to say life's not fair. You lost. If you think they cheated, so what? Your boss has cheated multiple times. Now it's his turn to get kicked in the dick, and no one cares about your feelings, and move on. If you want to go live off in the woods, or you want to go join a Trump cult and go live in a commune with Trump in his harem, then go feel free. But the rest of the country is going to move on, and we're just I'm over, you know.
Okay, I'm good with that. So,
what I wanted to bring up, so there's a couple stories of some police misconduct, and you know, we've got another person that was shot by police. And I just kind of want to I just want to highlight it because I think it's important. You know, the conversation about the phrase defund the police is still going on. And the conversation is focused on the phrase defund the police, right? Like, you've got Congress saying, oh, it's a bad phrase. Obama came out and said, well, it's not a great phrase. And people, you know, on progressive left are saying it is a great phrase and it shouldn't matter about the phrase. We need to do this, we need to do that. And everybody's talking about the phrase defund the police, right? Which I personally think when the phrase overtakes the mission, then maybe the phrase isn't so great. But besides that point, right, we have issues with policing still, people. Just here in Ohio, in Columbus, you had a guy, Casey Goodson Jr., who was shot in the back by a police officer going into his house. Now, the police officer said that they were at a crime scene. Goodson drove by, flashed his gun. They then drove after him. And then the story gets hazy, right? Like, there's not a clear explanation of what happened because the officer didn't have a body cam, right? And they always say, well, these particular officers don't wear body cams and they don't have to. And then if they do, they don't have to turn them on and blah, 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 blah. So there's no body cam footage. All you have is the story that the guy drove by, for some reason flashed a gun, The police went after him. The guy at some point had a Subway sandwich, you know, takes his Subway sandwich, gets out of his car, walks into his house. And then as he's walking into his house with the sandwich, the police shoot him. Right now, the guy was a licensed CCW holder. He didn't have a criminal background that we know of to this point. You know, multiple people have checked. Trust me, like, I mean, you know, a black guy gets shot, the first thing they do is they're going to run and check his criminal history. But there was no, he had no record, no warrants or anything like that. And, you know, the police say they recovered a gun, but he was a licensed CCW holder. So it's a little bit, I mean, it's just like, and they also don't say where they recovered the gun from, right? Did the gun, when he was shot and fell, was the gun on him? And did he, you know, did he then, you know, fall and the gun get kicked to the floor? Or did they shoot him and then go in the house and say, oh, look, a gun in the home that happens to be his? They don't make that clear. At least I haven't seen it to this point. The story's about a week old or so. There may be more information. But I mean, you know, nobody can. The story just not quite aligning or making any sort of sense, like why you would shoot a guy going into his house. There has to be another way to handle it. You know, I think, you know, there's a lot of questions to be answered there. We have another situation in Chicago where we're just seeing footage now of a woman. She's a social worker at a hospital who the police had a warrant, but it was for the wrong apartment, or it wasn't her apartment. And they got some bad information on a tip. They kicked her door in with a battering ram. She was naked. She had just got home from the hospital working, and they handcuffed her. They came in, guns pointed, you know, screaming, yelling what they do during the raid. It was the wrong house. They handcuffed her completely naked, and then, you know, put something over her shoulders, which, you know, covered basically nothing. And they were at the wrong place because of a bad tip from an informant. And again, now people will say, well, you know, they did everything right, except they just happened to be at the wrong place. And it's like, look, you got to verify where the fuck you're going. You got to do a little bit more investigation before you just go kicking in doors. And I don't care whether you're a 20-year veteran or rookie cop, or you've never been a fucking cop before. That's common sense.
Right.
Like, I'm not going to have this. I don't care. Like, cops get all pissed off. You've never been a cop. You don't understand. Fuck you. You clearly don't understand how to do your goddamn job. Otherwise, you wouldn't be kicking in the wrong door and fucking terrorizing people. You know, I mean, this is fucking insane.
It conjures up images to me of Aaron Hernandez getting arrested, because that he was not wearing a shirt when they arrested him. So he's already like pulled a t-shirt over him. Like, you can't see Aaron Hernandez's pecs in public, but you're going to drag a naked woman out of the streets. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's just absolutely insane. And going back to, you know, the warrant, I mean, you know, you can make a connection to Breonna Taylor and how she ended up dead. You know, they had, now that wasn't a situation where they had the wrong address. They had the right address, but they had also arrested the guy previously, you know, an hour before they kicked in her door and ended up killing her. And it's just like, her death could have been avoided with, you know, better sequencing, better timing. And if you know the guy wasn't there, right? Did you necessarily need to kick the door in at that point in time? Is there any way you could have done an investigation beforehand or after, or maybe just knocked on her door with, you know, have one of your detectives or something go and knock on her door and talk to her or something like that? It seems like there are other options besides going in with a team and kicking in the door, shooting Breonna Taylor. Fortunately, this woman wasn't killed. But it took her a year to get the body cam footage to get it released. And it's just, I mean, you know, these are the sort of things where this shit is happening to citizens, right? Yeah, they make less money than the average person, or they're black or whatever, but this one was a social worker, right? Like, I mean, she was a social worker. Breonna Taylor was an EMT. These are citizens of the United States. People's rights are being violated. Like, that, these are the sort of things where you want to get mad, you want to get out there and protest, you want to get pissed off and get be mad at the government. That's the sort of shit where you need to question your government, right? Wearing a fucking mask to you know, to deal with this fucking virus, that's not tyranny. That's not oppression, right? Like, I mean, people want to act like wearing a mask is getting, you know, like, I mean, people have made these crazy connections to slavery and all that other stuff, which is just wild. But, you know, what these police are doing, like, the police are an entity of the state, right? Like, right. They are controlled by the state. Like, this is the definition of government overreach. This is the definition of government, you know, violating the Constitution. And yet, you know, you can't get a reaction out of this. Nobody's heard these stories. No one cares, but they'll yap on and on and on about wearing fucking masks and how that violates right. Their rights.
And you mentioned the phrase defund the police being problematic. Jim Clyburn, the congressman from South Carolina, said it perfectly. He said, once you have to explain a slogan, it's not working as a slogan.
And you know what? And my issue with Jim Clyburn on that is that he spent so much time talking about that particular thing. It's like, Jim, yeah, you're right. I agree. And I think that's me and you. That's our job to kind of talk about how ridiculous it is. I need Jim Clyburn out there doing something about the fucking police. I don't care about the phrase. I don't care about the phrase. I just don't. I think it's dumb. I think it was a bad idea. I think that anyone from the beginning would have said, this is going to be the result, people arguing about the fucking words that we're using instead of actually addressing the issues that we need addressed. And here we are. But Jim Clyburn, I need you out there doing something about the fucking police. And now he's put forth some things and he's helping, but there's better things that he can be talking about besides how he doesn't like the phrase.
Fair. There's another police story coming out of San Diego. It is pretty fresh, but apparently police were violating the quarantine rules about dining out and going to bars and such. And there was an internal investigation that led to discovery of a video that apparently had been being passed around among police officers containing racial slurs directed at the mayor and images of Hitler. And I have not seen the video itself. So this is definitely a developing story that I'll try to keep an eye on, but I will not be surprised if this turns into something pretty ugly.
Yeah, I mean, and look, I mean, it's not, we've seen this multiple times before. We've seen it all over the country, from Baltimore to Chicago to New York to Cleveland, down in Texas, throughout in California. It doesn't matter. You see it everywhere, right? Now, it could be one or two officers. It could be, you know, an entire systemic police force. Right? You never know. But it's, again, it's just something else that needs to be looked at. You know, I don't know. You can't legislate out stupidity and hate and, you know, some of these feelings of white supremacy or whatever. You can screen better for it. You can train better for it. You can have stiffer penalties for when you find it. But it's, again, it's one of those other things that needs to be addressed. And how do we do it, right? I mean, you know, Kamala Harris is calling for blanket standards for, you know, the use of deadly force and some other, you know, kind of federal blanket standards, which I think, you know, have some pluses and minuses. You know, and a lot of this stuff has to be handled on an individual basis in, you know, the various communities and right. What they're willing to kind of deal with and put up with and then how they're willing to address it. But yet and still, it needs to be addressed and people need to be aware of it. So I think it's important that we continue to talk about these right. things as we find them.
It needs to be cultural change.
Yeah.
It needs to be flat out, what is policing? What does good police work look like? I'd like also talk a little bit of sports. Right now, the Big Ten championship game is going on, so we will not be able to tell what happened. It'll be news by the time you listen to this. But the NCAA has changed the rule for this year, allowing players to transfer without penalty. And one thing that I've always been furious with the NCAA about is that they let coaches jump ship even mid-season or late in the season if they've got a better offer. And they can just leave the program high and dry and just say, well, you got a bowl game coming up, but figure it out. I'm going off to Michigan. Yes, that was some West Virginia bitterness coming out. But players can't do that. And I don't think players should be able to jump ship at the end of or with the season going on. But to penalize a player and not let them get on the field with a different team if they legally transfer, I think is utter horseshit. Now, the NCAA is doing this for now. I doubt they'll stick with it. But I think it's bullshit. And I know you agree with me because it personally impacted you.
Yeah, the question is, once you kind of unfurl this, can you reel it back in? I don't know. I'm not as confident that the NCAA will be able to go back, because it's something that has been clamored for, and they're going to have a hard time justifying it. And I think it's something worth taking to court. I wish that it's something that would have been addressed, you know, a long time ago. It did impact me. It's one of the reasons why, you know, I opted to go to UMass from West Point instead of going, to Pitt or Michigan State or one of those schools. Not that, you know, I regret going to UMass. I think it was a great time and a great experience, but I had different opportunities that could have been available to me, but I couldn't take advantage of because of the rules in the NCAA in transferring. And I think it's an absolute shit rule for the exact reason that you said, that a coach, and I had this happen, our coach, my coach at UMass, now his situation was a little bit different. He left UMass to go to the NFL, right? Coach Whip left UMass to go and coach the Steelers, to be Ben Roethlisberger's quarterback coach, and they ended up winning a Super Bowl, so I'm not mad at that. That's a weird sort of thing for me. God, that was such a – my feelings were so weird then. But there were plenty of other coaches who have left their team at the end of a season with a game or two left to play, and then gone on other things with no penalty. And not only is there no penalty, but they get their money, right? Like they get buyouts, right? Or they still get paid, right? Or you can even fire a coach and he can take another job and he gets paid. And there's like this, sometimes there's offsetting language, sometimes there's not, but these coaches can just move freely, make ass loads of money off the backs of these players and student athletes. And it doesn't matter how good of a coach they are, right? Like you got Brett Bielema, who just got rehired at Illinois today, which Brett Bielema was a coach at Wisconsin. And then he went to Arkansas. He stunk it up at Arkansas. He was a position coach at the New York Giants. Now he's back with Wisconsin, or in the Big Ten at Illinois. But, you know, these coaches, like, they don't even have to be good, right? I mean, like, some of these coaches are average or whatever. They have a winning season or two at a mid-major school or whatever, or a small school, and they get bumped up. Or some of these big-time coaches jump ship and move over, and they do whatever the hell they want. And these kids are stuck sometimes. Like, listen, these coaches sell these kids on the world. Oh, we're going to take good care of you. We're going to make sure you're going to class. We're going to, you know, you're going to be a star in our program. You're going to run for 20,000 yards and blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. And then, you know, they get there and then the coaches, they don't play the kids, or, you know, whatever, it doesn't work out for the kid, right? Maybe the kid wants to be closer to home. Maybe he misses his girlfriend. I don't know. Maybe he doesn't like the weather, right? Maybe a kid, you know, comes to Ohio and thinks that, you know, Columbus is great, and then the weather hits and he's like, fuck this, I want to go back down south. Whatever it might be, these kids are basically trapped. And then it's like, oh, you can leave if you want to, but you can't go on scholarship, or you have to move down to a smaller school. And all these rules that just are patently unfair, and they completely favor the school, right? And it's not for any other reason than they don't want you to go to a school. What they wanted to avoid for the longest time was Joe Burrow, right? That's what they wanted to avoid, right? Joe Burrow left Ohio State because he didn't feel he was getting an opportunity to play. And then he went to LSU and was wildly successful and, you know, theoretically could have beaten Ohio State had they met in the playoff, right? And so that's why that rule was in place, because who makes up a big bulk of the NCAA, right? It's the people who work for the schools, right? The athletic directors and the school sports presidents, right? Like, they have a lot of say in the rules that happen with the NCAA, right? Like, so they feign this, oh my God, it's so unfair, but they're the reason why the rules are unfair. Right, like, they don't want these kids to be able to freely travel because it hurts their programs, right? This has nothing to do with benefiting the kids. It's all about making sure that the schools are protected, and especially when we're talking about multi-billion-dollar industries. And what's interesting is that these transfer rules, by the way, they only apply at Division I.
Right.
they don't apply at Division II and III, and maybe they apply at Division II, but they don't apply at Division III. And why is that? Because no one cares about Division III, right?
Like, there's no money in it.
There's no money in it, right? Like, Division III is, I mean, I've had my good friends play Division III, and they were really good, and it was really fun for them, and I enjoyed watching them when I could. Some of them even actually went on to play in the NFL from Division III. But the point is that these rules are in place to protect the big-time schools and the big money from, you know, kids being able to move freely. That's what it's all about.
Yep. And all right. I will be paying attention because I really hope this rule becomes a permanent thing.
I'm sorry. And one last thing. I mean, I've got a younger cousin who's playing at a Division II school right now, who before the coronavirus thing was considering transferring schools. And we went and we talked to multiple schools, Division I schools. Now, mind you, he's 6'5", 240 pounds, and runs a 4.5 40. He's a giant. He's a freak. And schools wanted him, but there was so many issues with the NCAA and him entering the portal and being able to transfer, not being able to transfer and everything else, that he was like, look, man, this is more than I was willing to bite off and chew, and more than I don't know if I could handle all of that in school and class and everything else. And then Corona hit, so, you know, ended up staying put. But it's just ridiculous what they put on these kids. And they say, well, we're giving you a scholarship, so we should have this amount of control. But the student athletes provide so much in terms of money and everything else for the schools that balance of power, I believe, needs to shift. Now, if you want to say that, well, they're 18, they're young kids, they shouldn't have that much control, bullshit. If you're going to fucking dump kids with, you know, $20, $30, $50, $100,000 worth of student loans, right? Like, you're okay with dumping kids with that sort of responsibility where they're going to have to work for years to pay it off, then the kids can have some control when they get scholarships too. It's a bullshit, you know, argument that doesn't make sense.
Agreed. In fact, the one thing I will say is, when I was in college, transferring from one engineering school to another wasn't so bad. Schools have now done this with academics too. They don't say you can't go to school for a year, but they ridiculously block what you can transfer.
That is bullshit. They kill you on credits. Like, I mean, you're going from one program to the other. They're very similar. And it's like, oh, well, that class doesn't count, so you can't use it as credits. Which is just, which I think is flat out criminal, because what they're doing is they're forcing these kids to spend additional money on these credit hours that they shouldn't have to spend because they already spent them at their previous school. My cousin, his sister actually went through that when she left Tiffin and then came to Cleveland State. You know, she was 2 years in and they basically didn't give her credit for basically what accounts for a year. And now she's having to spend that time and money at Cleveland State, which is just a joke. But it's still saving her $40,000 a year. So,
right.
But yeah, you know, I mean, obviously, this is a sore topic for me and my family in general. So, you know, I'll definitely be watching as well.
And it all comes down to greed, because Calculus One at WVU and Calculus One at Maryland are essentially the same thing. So, if at the end I can do calculus, WVU shouldn't have double charged me, and they didn't. But that I guarantee you, if I tried to do that today, they'd screw me over.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, maybe not with calculus because it's relatively universal. But I mean, I mean, we saw it with my cousin. I mean, firsthand with her classes, so many that didn't transfer, and it was absolutely ridiculous that they didn't. So anyway, let's go ahead and shut it down, man. This is a good session between Ben and then Ben. We want to thank Ben for the market talk. And, you know, obviously we're still doing the isolation thing. I'm officially done with quarantine after my COVID experience. You know, like it was over yesterday, and I'll be reintegrating myself to the rest of the world over the next couple of days, but definitely will be glad to get out of my house.
I'm sure. It's good to hear. We are at Whiskey Congress on Instagram, Twitter, and Parler. Ben is Existential One, EXIS10IAL on Twitter. Thanks for listening.
I don't think Ben's on Parler.
We should have asked him. All right. Well, thanks for listening. We are done. Go ahead and